whenever I'd go for a ride, I'd get unquestionably lost. But I learned pretty quickly that all I needed to do was go downhill and run into a river somewhere and then keep going on down.
We're here today with Harley Stimmel, one of the co-owners of the Red Rock Ranch with his wife, Carolyn. Being a West Texas boy, Harley initially found navigating the mountains around Red Rock Ranch challenging. But years on the ranch has put some Wyoming in his blood, and now Harley is full of fun stories about the ranch. Stick around to hear about the history and future of Red Rock Ranch, and to get dropped into wildlife encounters, intentional backflip horse dismounts, losing horses in the woods, and yes, getting lost in the woods himself. 2024 marks 50 years of the Red Rock Ranch and the McKenzie family, so we'll talk about its history, current sustainability practices, and look ahead to where it's going as well. Let's get started. You're in for a treat. Harley, why don't you just tell me a little bit about yourself and your relationship with Red Rock Ranch?
Like I said, I was born and raised around horses. Fortunately, horse-oriented people. My dad worked for a small independent oil company there in Midland, Texas, but he was a big, really good polo player, and he knew how to ride real well. And so my mom was also raised on a ranch in California, and she was born and raised around horses. So it wasn't a question of whether you either could walk or you could ride. So I chose to ride, and that's basically how I learned to ride at a young age. And like I said, I did compete. My mom was very active world and judging and showing and all that. We're very well-rounded, and her family had a ranch out in California, which is still in the family as well. So that I grew up going to that ranch in the summertime, and I learned feeding and all the hay and all that. It was an amazing way on. And, you know, we got that going on a semi-regular basis. Like I say, I used to do the professional. Then Karen's dad called me up one day and asked me if I'd think about being the head wrangler. I told him, I said, well, let me think about that. It was like March and they hadn't found the head wrangler yet. And so I'd been used to being around horses and people, and I thought, well, I'll try it out. There again, you know, the funny thing about that was, is on my first, here I am, the head wrangler, and I didn't even know where the trails were. We had a group from, I think they were from Michigan, and they came as a family on the opening week, and I said, okay, here we go, you know, and so we just kind of ride around up there, you know, and I didn't know where I was going, but I kind of kept the ranch in sight and made it work. But it was really kind of cool because they didn't know where they were going either. It was a good, easy opening, I guess, for me.
And
so I kind of went on from there and, like say, did the head wrangler thing. One of Karen's brothers and myself and the chef were kind of a general manager type situation there. Been able to fit in a couple of different areas. I'm back at being part and parcel general manager right now. It's overwhelming for me, though, because I'm not really good on what I call being on the other side of the irrigation ditch. There's an irrigation ditch that flows through the middle of the ranch. On one side is the barn and the horses, and on the other side is housekeeping and food and beverage. And I'm not very familiar with that signed over there. I'm with us in the housekeeping, but doing the best I can anyway. What I found too about being in Wyoming and being around the people that have been raised in that area, especially, not that, you know, there aren't other people like that in Wyoming, but they rise above all that. And I mean, it's phenomenal to me what people do and did, you know, back in the day to make things work, especially with the winters the way they are. Being remote too adds a whole nother dimension to it, if you will. Those kind of challenges, it seems like it brings up that try and that gumption. Also just having our boys being able to stay up there during the winter too and being raised that way. Literally, that youngest son of ours, well, they're all that way, but they learn how to fix their own tractors and they learn how to make it work.
That's awesome. So obviously, you're not accepting guests year-round, are you?
No, this winter, for the first time, we did a small winter operation. Our second son, Jig, and his girlfriend, Allison, put on a would do a little lunch deal for John Toulson's snow machine outfit. We've been wanting to try that for several years, and by golly, he pulled it off. Obviously, y'all had a short winter up there, but they came off it enough, it worth trying out, that it was kind of cool. It had the snow machine right in and park the machine, go in and have a great lunch, and there's a warm room in there and the good restrooms. It worked out. But yeah, normally we don't do that. We just do the summertime thing. We're still open June 9th this year, and we'll close probably depending, but mid-September.
So that kind of hints at diversification. As the kids have grown up on the ranch and seen opportunities to tackle and kind of work toward that diversification, what other forms of diversification are you guys going after 50 years?
It's a fine line, and I've got to make a decision really as to what you focus on, because if you get focused on too many things, then you're not really focused on anything if you overdo it. But for me, I'd like to branch out into some type of farming. We do our own hay. I think we've got enough land that I wouldn't call it row crops or whatever, but something that has to do with either the organic side of things and utilize our the land a little better than we do. Not that it doesn't get utilized, but it's mainly we don't get a lot of income off of it. And it's I won't call it a battle, but it is difficult right now just because of the assessment taxes are high enough to where you really have to have a pretty good income just to pay that. But I get it. It's an unusual area, and there's a lot going on, with people moving in that can afford to purchase some of the bigger places. And so we have to abide by the regulations, which have a pretty good cash flow to keep up with that. But it's in a good thing, and I get it. It's too beautiful of an area. We wouldn't, obviously, and I'm sure Carolyn brought it up, but it's most of it is all in conservation. Her parents were really big on that. We want to keep that legacy too. Well, it doesn't get developed.
Right. You seem like a very flexible, roll with it kind of person, just someone who gets along with just about everybody. You're talking about the Forest Service and getting along with all those players. I can't see not getting along with you. How does that personality affect how the ranch runs?
Well, sometimes I get in trouble because I'm a little too lenient, I think. But what I always tell my boys, just watch me. I'll make most all the mistakes around here. And then I said, y'all just take note because y'all don't have to make all the mistakes I make. Just watch me, And as I say, not as I do. But yeah, I try to be, I guess I was just raised that way. My mom and dad, my dad was in the Navy as well. And he, served in World War II, and he had to put up with an awful lot, and he was a very good people person. But I think a lot of it stems from his example being in years and just being able to talk to whoever it was. We always had some strange, not in a bad way, but just strange people come to dinner. He wouldn't turn anybody down hardly, but that was also due to the polar world plus being involved. My dad worked for a small independent oil company there. Just getting to know that side of things too. I didn't ever study it like from a geological standpoint or anything, but I was around those kind of people too.
Right.
So that just helped a lot. I think being in polo is amazing too that way. If it wasn't for polo, I wouldn't have met Carolyn as an example because she wanted to learn to play polo, and that's kind of how we met was through a mutual friend that was a polo player. It's a small world, and you can travel and you meet people that you wouldn't ordinarily meet. It's amazing that way. So I think that's a lot of it too, is being able to be adaptable, be able to talk to people, not that I'm any in-depth conversation with, seem to get along, fit in, try to help people out, me too.
So let's back this up a little bit. You mentioned meeting Carolyn in Polo. So how did that kind of take shape?
Oh, what it is, I had just graduated from college, and I moved out. I had a what you call a playing job when I was playing professionally in Palm Springs, California. And there's a mutual friend of ours, original name was Marley Flanders. She's from the same town in Illinois that Carolyn was from. And she spent a lot of time there in Jackson, and to this day, actually. But anyway, to make a long story short, she introduced me to Carolyn. Like I said, just kind of one of those happenstance things that she happened to be from the same town in Illinois as Carolyn did. Was, in fact, we just saw her the other day. But she's an amazing person, too. Carolyn had already learned how to ride, but she really wanted, she saw Polo there in California. She said, "Hell, I'm trying that." So I invited her to Midland to come play in a little tournament. Of course, she didn't really have any idea what she was getting herself into, but she's a very competitive and athletic person, and it didn't take her. She plays more than I do now.
You bonded over polo.
Correct. Yeah. Horses and polo. Big time.
That's fun. So growing up around horses, what did that do for your work ethic?
I guess the biggest thing with horses are the care. You know, there's as much goes on what you call the ground as there is, if not more, in the riding and training part of things, and learning how to care for them, and learning how to, we're always on the move. Like Carolyn today drove 2.5 or close to 2 hours to the veterinarian to get, we have to draw blood on horses to ship, what we call ship horses, to Wyoming. Anytime you cross state lines, you've got to have what they call a cognitive exam, and they draw blood just to make sure that colds, flu, they horses get sick just like we did. But it's a restriction that you have to have both a, what they call a health certificate and a draw blood on to make sure they're good to go. So she'll spend a good 5 or 6 hours doing that alone. You know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big part of it is it can be a lot of work, but it's also very rewarding. Especially when you learn, the more you learn about them, of course, the better it is. But just being able to be around their nature, horses are amazing to me as far as their nature is concerned. I learn something, try to learn something every day from them. They're very, very aware. They're like, I wouldn't say they're on the, I'd say some of them are on the same wavelength as dogs.
Uh-huh.
Where they can sense your attitude, your emotion, and they're like, they'll look at you. They're like, mm-hmm. Yeah, he's in a bad mood today, you know. But anyway, to make a long story short, that's the gist of it. It's just obviously a lot of the good trainers and, well, anybody in any horse discipline, the really good ones, they hire people to take care of them, but they still got to go out there and get along with them too.
Right.
Competing or doing whatever they're doing. You probably know this, but they've got a really good little polo club there in Jackson.
Yeah, they do. So you mentioned that you have learned a lot from the horses. You try and learn something every day from them. What's an example of something you've learned from horses?
I'd say paying attention, really, because they're so sensitive to your touch, to your mannerism, to literally the way you walk up to them. But I think the predominant thing is just being aware. Now, why did that horse do what he did? Or asking myself, okay, you know, it takes two to tango. Now, why did he act that way? It's an old saying in the horse world. What happened before what happened happened? if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
And really, you know, when you think about it, it carries over to people too, you know, because why is that person acting that way? I'm around that kind of thing. Instead of just say, oh, well, that's great, whatever it is. You know, horses have their, obviously have their mannerisms and their problems, but for me, it's just learning to be aware of what happened with respect to people.
Okay, so does that ever lead to that sensitivity? Does that ever lead to kind of some run-ins with the guests?
Oh, big time. And well, there's two parts to that, I guess. It's not only people and guests, but it's also horses and guests. So I really got it handed out to those horses that they just keep trooping along, you know, and they know when they've got somebody that is, I wouldn't call it compromised, but most people that come to the ranch, you know, they may have ridden one time before, or if they're repeat guests, the last time they rode was the last time that they were at the ranch, you know. So you've got to really have some horses that are able to just, we call them weight packers, that you get on them and they just go, and they got a great work ethic, and they're just amazing, really. I mean, and our season isn't as long as other ranches, but we, you well know, we have the altitude, we have the rocks, we have the steepness, and it's a lot for them to pack somebody, maybe pack with the wrong word, but carry somebody who isn't in rhythm with their, it's like a dance almost, because you can feel underneath pretty much where they are, but people aren't aware. A lot of people, unless they're just naturally athletic, they won't feel that. It's kind of like bouncing on a trampoline. You can be in rhythm with them, but there's certain people that don't feel that, or will go on a longer trail ride and they get tired, bottom line, you know, and pretty soon they're invariably, what will happen is somebody will lean more to one side, the dominant side, than the other side. So you always got to be looking out for that, because then their saddle will slip a little bit or just enough to, you know. So we're always on the lookout for that kind of thing, because you can imagine just being in that saddle for up to 8 hours off and on, and having, especially the people that aren't real fit.
Right.
It's hard on them too. So we got to be careful. Obviously, we start out slow on Mondays, and then we increase a little bit on Tuesdays. And then some people say, well, I'm heading up for another day. We'll skip on Wednesday and we'll ride on Thursday and try to just take care of them so that they don't get so sore that it's not fun, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the good thing about it is most people have done their homework and they know what they're getting into, 99% anyway. You'll have the odd person or family or whatever that somebody else has done the homework, so to speak, and they don't really know what they're getting into, and they don't know that we're remote and they're used to going to Starbucks right next door, or, you know, Evan or whatever, and then like, oh my God. And see if, like, by Wednesday they calm down and relax.
So is that something, like, you kind of witness a decompression over the first few days for these guests? I mean, a lot of these people are in high-pressure jobs and careers, so I imagine that there's kind of a disconnect period that they have to go through before they are kind of at ease for the rest of the week. Is that, would you say, accurate? And what have you witnessed with the guests?
I'd say there's only a very small percentage that carry that, like you said, carry that angst and that gotta be check my phone type thing. Very few will go past Wednesday and still carry that on. It's like you say, usually on midday Tuesday or Wednesday at some point, they're like, yeah, they'll just leave their phone in the cabin or whatever, or their computer or whatever. And I get it. Some people have to do it. Some amazing people that come from California, the group, and they're the same way. They'll be doing meetings, Zoom meetings, you know, on Thursday afternoon, or I got to get back a little early, that kind of thing. So we try to accommodate it, and I get it that some people don't have that luxury of being able to turn off their computer for a whole week. But the cool thing is they jump back in. They don't just carry it over. They appreciate being helped out in that manner, and we've got fairly decent internet. You have landline, and you can occasionally get cell service, the internet, and all that. So, but ideally, yeah, we try to keep people, and especially their kids, keep them off the phone. streaming and all that.
I think that's a good policy to follow. When you're in nature, be in nature. Leave the screens behind. Do you see people kind of adapt toward that through their time on the whole?
Oh, big time. And they'll, you know, and then like my oldest son, he's real into the hiking part of things. He'll take him on the sunrise hike for the ones that want to get up real early in the morning. And they'll go up on really good places that you can see the Grand Teton from, and they'll watch the sunrise. And just being out, we're so fortunate, like say, to have the access to both the Grovar Wilderness plus Grand Teton. It's amazing. Of that, right in your back door.
Yeah, I will be the first to agree with you on that.
I mean, it's crazy when you think about it, because we don't even cover 1/10 of it, 1/50 of it.
Right.
But those people appreciate it, you know, being that close to the. It's difficult sometimes too to match up. You got to match up the right horse to the right person, and we've got to. Currently have a really good head wrangler that'll go around and ask questions, and they'll know, you know, well, maybe I need to put you on Shadow, and I need to put you on, you know, Wintermaker or wherever, you know. But it's been that, you know, that's another key essential tenet in our world, in guest ranch world, is being able to read people enough to where, okay, this is the horse for you.
That's an interesting concept, kind of the matchmaker between the people and the horses.
Oh man, huge. And you got to know them, you know, and that's where, like, we've never had as, I don't ever remember, not that I've been there forever, but having this many applicants for wranglers and servers, and had a few, not as many for housekeeping, that kind of thing. But to be honest with you, through the years, and I wasn't always involved with hiring, but I'm really encouraged by the younger generation right now. I mean, a lot of times I think they take a bad rap, but I don't know, that they're out there, man. I mean, and it was real responsible, and they want to do way more accountable. And yes, it's hard to find. Not all the time you can find somebody that's been raised, what I call raised around horses, but I've been surprised. They're out there, and then a lot of them, they're in college, and they had to stop riding or being around horses and really tend to their schoolwork.
Let's dissect that a little bit more. Do you think it's the whole generation that's getting that mentality, or is it the cross-section of the generation that is attracted to ranch work?
Both. Because, yeah, they want to, a lot of them, of course, already have jobs or graduated or they're about to graduate, and they're getting shoot in, you know, to a professional job or whatever, and they want to take one more last summer off, you know, before they do that. But it's kind of cool to see that, you know, because they're not just jumping out there, and we pay well, but still they could probably make quite a bit more doing what their profession is. They still want to take that time before they get immersed into the business world or whatever. But yeah, to me, it's just real encouraging though to see that, and think the younger generation get criticized, but we've been very fortunate to have amazingly good help. Couldn't do it without them.
Right. In our pre-interview, you talked about you'd come in from West Texas, you got the flats, and it's basically, I would guess, all by where the sun sits in the sky. And you came here and you said you got lost a lot. I would love to hear a great story about getting lost and what that looked like.
Well, what it boils down to is that one of the first times I got lost, I forget why I went where I went, but this wasn't really any further. Probably as the crow flies, is only probably maybe 3 miles, 4 miles from the ranch. And I was riding a mare that was off the racetrack. She wasn't accustomed to being in mountainous areas or rocky trails or elk and deer and possibility of seeing a bear or a wolf or whatever. So she was what I'd call, we call them green. You know, they're not used to that kind of thing. They're young and they're just not like some of those mountain horses that have been raised there, you know. Anyway,
Right.
make a long story short, I did what you're not supposed to do. First thing I did was go across the river when it was too high in the spring runoff. But luckily, I made it across. Then I went up over on the west side of the ranch. There's a really steep trail that goes up into what they call East Minor and West Minor, which is right above where the Meadows have their land still.
All right, beautiful, beautiful lakes up there.
Yo, man, it's incredible, and it's right there, you know, right in your backyard. That was, and I think that had a lot to do with it. I just wasn't paying attention. I was just like, oh, my God, that's so nice, you know. Yeah, both those little streams coming out of the mountains up there. One of them comes out of Lee Minor, and the other one comes up out of East Minor. Anyway, so I was riding around. I was looking for cattle. My father-in-law kept cattle up there. He had the permit now. It belongs to the meat now, right above the ranch to run cattle. And so I got up there, and this mare fell into a bog, like a, I wouldn't call it quicksand, but it was close. And it was far enough, you know, she fell into this. And of course, she had no idea, you know, what was going on. And she fell clear in literally the bottom part of my saddle and my stirrups were in the mud. And so she kind of pulled over on her side. And then I jumped off. And then she got up and took off. I couldn't catch her right quick. And I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do now? Not that it was a big thing to be that happened, but it kind of freaked me out because, in all honesty, at that point in time, I didn't even know where I was in relation to where I started from.
Uh-huh.
So I meandered around in there. I took probably an hour, hour and a half, and it was in a real wooded, very tall trees. And like you say, it was still spring runoff, so there was a lot of boggy, muddy places, and there still is actually a really nice spring up there. And so I ended up, she took off, and one of the reins attached to the bridle, she got caught up in a bush. I just got lucky and found her hooked up to this bush. And Lord knows what would have happened if I hadn't found her. I mean, But anyway, that was just one example of, and then I was like, well, how am I going to figure out where to get down, you know? And that's when I thought, well, I'll just follow this stream, get where I can see something that might look. And sure enough, all I had to do was ride about a half a mile, three quarters of a mile, and top out on one of those ridges right there to the west of the ranch. And he looked down the whole Grosmont Valley. You know, it's amazing, the Grosmont River over to the east and northeast. And so I knew the ranch was around to the right or to the south, but I had no idea of northeast, you know, west, south. It was just totally, just didn't make sense. It just did not look like where I needed to go was south, you know, that kind of thing. But that's how I learned. My father-in-law let me run the cattle the rest of the summer. And so I'd have to pack salt up into the mountains there. And that was like heaven for me to be able to do that, because I'd always wanted to be a cowboy, you know. And to build, and I had to learn to do the pack saddle thing. And it was so cool, though, because I didn't really have to go on trails. I'd just go where I thought they were going, or in what we do, what we call, you know, pack ahead of them. The Forest Service mandates areas where you can start out, and then at a certain time, like 30 days, you have to move them to another area, like move them over to Grizzly Lake over there, and then allow them to stay there for another 15, 20 days, and then you'd have to go to West Mine. So we were always riding a lot, just keeping in what would happen. It's those cows would, there's a lot more people that go up there now, but people park their cars down there alongside the Grosmont, and then they hike up to Grizzly Lake and fish or swim or whatever, and then come back out. Well, the cattle would start following them out. They wouldn't stay up there. But it was cool, though, you know, because we go saddle up, move them back, and that's how the boys were raised, essentially, was pushing those cows and learning the trails. They know it better than I do now.
Yeah. So give me a good adventure story about working the ranch.
I think the one thing that happened before I was even really directly involved with the ranch, my father and I had this amazing head wrangler that was from Texas. He's from San Antonio, and he actually still lives semi close by to where we are now. But he started out, they said that he walked in 2 years before I met him, wanted a job as a chore boy. We call him chore boy. They're maintenance, basically mow the grass and weed eat and all that. He was one of those kind of guys that are natural around people. I mean, amazing. He'd just talk to anybody and help them out, and just real accommodating. And he was smart, did well in school. He was a musician. Anyway, make a long story short, somehow he got to be the head wrangler the following year, but he didn't know anything about horses. He could ride, you know, a little bit, and he'd like to say he's a good athlete. Well, so I went down there. He was standing around. We have this big board, whiteboard outside the barn. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and he was like, you know, and all the guests were standing around there. Where I was, man, what's going on over there? He goes, hey, Harley, come here a minute. He said, I need some help. He said, I don't know where the horses are. Of course, I didn't know any more than he did as far as where the horses could be. But I said, well, they probably didn't come in then, you know, because what we do is we wrangle every morning. We have to go on either north or south pastures and bring in all the horses, and we bring them in. They're usually in by 7 o'clock in the morning, 6:30 to 7. Go have breakfast. Then the guests come out about 8:30 and start leaving for the day on the rides. Well, the horses weren't even, you couldn't even see where they were, much less go saddle them up. So I said, well, we better saddle up and go find them, you know. And so sure enough, we went up above the ranch, and they had gotten out, and they were headed like to Jackson. I mean, they were like on a mission to get as far as they could, as quick as they could, off the ranch. But it was just really fun, though, because, you know, you had to go there again. You couldn't go on trail. You had to do what you had to do. But we got them back in. In fact, I saw one of the biggest mule deer I've ever seen up there in those hills up to the west of the ranch. But that's one kind of episode. I think what really resonated, I don't know if you knew them or not, but there was a family called the Engels that were from Riverton. They ran cattle up where, I don't know if you're familiar with Slate Creek. It's over off the Grove, flows into the Grove. It's over by Lighty Peak.
Okay, yeah, I know Lighty, but I don't know that creek.
Well, it flows the opposite way towards the south, and it runs into the Grovemont. But there's like acres and acres up there, and there's a place called Bear Paw Cabin up there that Roy Martin, I don't know if you've heard that name before or not, but he was worked for the Meads, and he also worked for my father-in-law. But he built this amazing cabin, and he had to pack in all the logs and all the, he knew how to coat the logs and all that, but he would pack in, and it's still there, you know. But bottom line, he was their herd, what they call the herdsman. Anyway, a period of time went by, and this guy named Danning got the permit to run the cattle up there. And so they were an amazing family. There's like 8 kids in there, and they would bring like 300 or 400 head of cattle. And so we'd go down and help them move from the lake all the way up what they call the dew place on the upper elk feed ground that's up way up, like 10 more miles. So anyway, we were going to go help them, and they had an old school bus that they changed into a kind of a living quarter deal, and they put all their food and everything in there. And these kids, they'd go out riding and moving the cattle during the day. And so I thought, well, I'll take our boys up there. We'll go up there and help them out. Well, we get up there, and there's one little log cabin with a corral beside it across the Grovemont, and it's called the Dew Place. It's one of the original cabins that's still up there. I took my horses over there and put them in the pen, and then came back to the camp across the river just about dusk. Two of those kids came riding in, and we had a fire going, and we were trying to cook some steak or whatever we brought up there, and they just jumped off their horses, threw their reins down. They were like exhausted, totally exhausted. And I thought to myself, I thought, man, if those were my kids, I'd make them go take care of their horses first, you know. I didn't say anything. Make a long story short, I look out across the river, and I see these horses go flying by their leaf. And I was like, man, I wonder if these horses are, well, they were my horses.
No.
And it looked really funny, me trying to go run out there and as if I was going to really matter it at all. they were like headed out. They were like gone. Well, those two kids jumped on their horses and they ran out there in 20 minutes. They had them all rounded back up and put back in the pen. To me, that was just like, okay, Harvey, you know, you need to wake up here. You know, there are these two kids, and I guarantee you they weren't maybe 12 to 15 years old, their brothers. They rode in with their horses. They dropped their reins, but they left their horses ready and saddled. And to me, that was just a huge eye-opener, because there I was thinking that I was going to go across the river and catch them. Yeah, I mean, it was a good lesson, though, you know. But there was a lot of that still goes on in a way, because those Wyoming people that have been raised in the mountains, and I've been so fortunate to be around some of those people that are been raised third or fourth generation or whatever. And I mean, there's no way that I could do what they did.
You just mentioned wildlife, bears and wolves, and you have all that in the neighborhood. What's a memorable encounter that you've had with wildlife, particularly as it pertains to guests, as they've experienced it for the first time?
Well, so there's one instance where there was a couple from, I think they're from North Carolina, South Carolina, but they would come every year, and they were good riders. They'd always want to do, you know, whatever I was doing, or they didn't want to just go on the usual guest ride type thing. So we had a dog. He's what you call a Catahoula, stock dog. But anyway, I said, come on, let's go up above the ranch, and we'll go. It was in the afternoon. They had just gotten there kind of deal, and it was overcast and cloudy and kind of semi-foggy, cold, but not bad, but it was just kind of that early season type weather. We ride out to the east ranch, and we ended up on some pretty high terrain. It was probably at the 9,000+. And I was not familiar with the area once again, so I hadn't had against him. Also, I had brought that dog with me. He was kind of a quirky dog, and so he took off after a deer. I didn't think much about it because I didn't like it when he did that. Unfortunately, I didn't have a shock collar or something on him because I didn't want him to do that to begin with, but he was a little bit that way. And I had these two guests with me, and so we were up there looking around, you know, for cattle or whatever it was, and it was getting a little on the dark side. Thought, you know what, we probably better head back, but we didn't take a trail into where we were. We just bushwhacked. When that dog took off, you could hear him, wow, 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 and then all of a sudden, nothing, no noise. And then it was like, you know, the other kind of like something's chasing him. So we thought, oh, boy, because I started looking around, and where we were standing had been a wolf den.
Oh, no.
And you could see bones, and I don't know why I didn't pick up on that earlier. But sure enough, man, and so that was the last time I saw that dog.
Oof.
And we even went back up the next day and all that kind of thing. But that just goes to show you one lesson right there. And that, and you know, the odd thing is that guy that I was telling you about, he couldn't be there. The dad couldn't be there all the time. And they ran a pack of those dogs. In fact, that's where I got the dog. He ran like 15 of those dogs. And I asked him about that at one time. I said, why do you have so many of those dogs? He said, Well, at night times, I figure if the wolves come into their campground, they'll get the dogs and not the kids.
Oh.
That was like, oh my God.
That is a very pragmatic answer.
Oh, and he meant it too. But, and it's not only that, but I guess the real thing about it too is he told me that the bears wouldn't come around either. And I didn't realize the importance of that, but he said that bears don't like dogs, and wolves are a different deal. Because they'll come in, and wreak havoc on dogs. But bears, apparently, unless you corner them up, they don't like the scent of dogs. So he would always take the dogs with him when they went out. And he said that he witnessed several times where he'd see a bear, they'd look back and see a bear that was trying to follow them, and once they had hit the smell of those dogs, they'd turn around and leave.
Huh.
We've had that happen. I don't know why I kind of forgot about this, but we had that happen with two mountain lions, too.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I took Joe Mack, our youngest son, on a trail on a camping, little short camping trip one time up in East Minor, and he was young. He's probably about 8, 9. Anyway, we get up there and camp out, had a good time, spent 2 nights, and we went back down. And the head wrangler at the time, he asked me, he said, where'd you go camping at? And he said, and I said, oh, up in East Minor where we usually have months. And he goes, well, did you see that mountain lion up there? And I said, what mountain lion? He goes, well, you were camped about 100 yards away from where they built a little mound and they marked their territory.
Uh-huh.
There's a huge mountain lion up there. Anyway, what you don't know don't hurt you, I guess. But you don't know, especially with mountain lions and even bears, too. You got to have eyes in the back of your head. Luckily, I've been fortunate that way. We had one other instance where we did jump a mountain lion. This mountain lion ran for quite a ways, probably 200 or 300 yards. And the boys weren't very old. I think Stephen, our oldest son, was probably like 12, 13, on down to Joe Mack, the youngest one. He was about 6. We were all wrong horses. For some odd reason, I got it in my head that we'd go follow it to see if we could see it again. So we were riding through the trees, and Joe Mack, our youngest son, was a little bit ahead of me. And I looked over to my right, and not 30 yards away, this mountain lion is crouched down, and he's swishing his tail, and he's looking right at that little kid.
Oh, man.
But that goes to show you there's just a lot you got to be aware of, And we were just lucky. We were very lucky that day.
That's my wife's worst nightmare. She makes me stay within 20 feet of the kids at all times on trails because of mountain lions. And don't tell her that story, please.
Yeah. Well, I did assume you can do what you want. But it is it's a caveat, because in any respect, because even when you think you know where you are and you know it does, especially with mountain lions and, well, any animals too, they see you way
right.
You see them a lot of times.
So I noticed a line on the website talking about how you'll go down by the river and look for poachers. What does that refer to?
Well, on either end of the ranch, especially on the north side of the ranch, the Crystal Creek flows through the whole ranch on either end. But what happens is people will park their cars and then they'll hike in. You can't see right there at the bottom on either end, actually. You kind of have to be real aware and then be able to hike up high to see if somebody's in there. But it's mainly, and to be honest with you, I think a lot of people just don't know. I'd like to think that anyway. They're not out there poaching so much. Yes, we do have it happen, but there is a part of the ranch, too, on the west side where it is actually on U.S. Forest Service land. But it goes on U.S. Forest Service, and then about 50, 60 yards further down, it's back on ranch. So it's a little confusing too. And some people pick up on it or are able to, like, I haven't been in there, but that fly shop on in town there, they've got a map in there, and I have through the years had people show up and they said, well, we're not on your property, you know. And I didn't even realize that about 10 years ago till lately. But it is interspersed, and we do have to probably abide by what the U.S. Forest Service wants to do. And bottom line is, it is, you well know, up in there, river will flood now and then. So back in the day, when the pioneer type people were there, they built the fences to accommodate the ranch, not the Forest Service. So consequently, you've got interspersed Forest Service land mixed in with private land. So that's kind of what we're dealing with right now. And so we've worked out a way, you know, around it. We get a special use permit from the Forest Service. But yeah, you do have that. It's just good to go try to check periodically, because, you know, we try to keep the river as pristine as we can, as far as people using treble hooks and regular casting rods. We try, you know, it's not so bad if you got somebody that's poaching that knows how to fish. If you got people that don't know how to fish and they're using casting rods, then you got a problem.
Right. Okay. I found a comment from some of your previous guests that talk about you and Carolyn doing a great job on carrying forward the visions of Debbie and Dave. How much has their vision influenced how you run the ranch versus how much spin have you injected into the ranch through your own tenure?
Well, I approach that nowadays with mixed emotion, because we're trying to run it like Pops and D. We call them Pops and D, Carolyn's mom and dad, and they're amazing people. But it was their vision, so we're kind of going along here and we're trying to run it with their vision. It has occurred to me a couple of times through the years, and especially right now, what is our vision? To try, and believe me, I'm dealing with it as we speak, as far as sustainability.
Uh-huh.
We have four boys, and it's very difficult for it to support that many. They all wanted to work there at the same time. It just wouldn't be a viable thing. So that's what we're dealing with right now, is just the future and what's that going to look like, and try to make it amenable to, if one of the boys wants to go be a lawyer or, like Joe Mack did, go be in the Navy, they can come back in 10 years and feel welcome. That's the ideal situation. But how do you make that work is another thing.
Right.
What we're trying to do is figure out an immutable way to do that.
So let's dwell on that a little bit. We have 50 years of this ranch being in the McKenzie family now.
Right.
Looking forward 50 years, still in the McKenzie family, what does it look like?
Well, and that's, to be honest with you, that's what I'm dealing with, Carolyn, too, is trying to figure out how would you go about doing that so that it is a place where they can all gather and participate if they want, or not participate. But ideally, I think it's more of a, if they don't like guest ranching, that's the premier thing is, okay, if you guys don't want to run the guest ranch, then we need to diversify it and come up with some other ways of doing things so that you can still pay the taxes and the insurance and the utility bills and that kind of thing, but still maintain the way it deservedly can carry it. Those cabins, they were old when they brought them up to the ranch.
Yeah.
50 years ago, you know. So that's also something we're looking at, too, is, hey, what are we going to do with these cabins? You know, are we going to try to rebuild them? Are you going to try to keep refurbishing them up, you know, all the time? So there's a lot on the table still that we haven't figured out that way. And it's a huge question, even 10 years from now, because two of them have kids already. And that's another thing, too, is how's that going to look? It's a good problem, don't get me wrong.
Right.
We're looking at it hard. You know, the funny thing is, there's other people in the valley that come over and, hey, Tony King, what are y'all doing to kids? We're trying to figure out what we're doing, you know. And anyway, we're not the only one.
The intergenerational aspect of guest ranches is really fascinating to me. I came from a family business, and so I kind of see some of those dynamics in play in the family business, but it's to a different level when it's such a place-based business as well. And there's just that attachment to the land. And if we got four boys that all want kind of their own piece of the ranch going forward, it is a big problem to solve. And then when they start having kids, it's going to be even more so.
Oh, man. Things happen. Some of them, they get married, and then the wife doesn't like it, or they want to bail out or something. And there's just no telling. I'm learning that on our side of the family, too. It's just got to try to roll with it and figure out the best way to either divide it up or do something where you know, the ideal thing is to have it is enabled some kind of way, you know, have a trust fund for it or something. Carries it along, and so they don't feel like they have to be out there raising hay every year just to pay the light bill, you know.
Right.
That's the hard part, really, when you think about it, this maintaining thing.
How big is the ranch?
It's close to a section of land, and it is, like I say, it's hard to put a definite figure on the acreage, but it's probably around a little over 450 along in there, but every year we go through this with the Forest Service, so in a good way, they've been real proactive here lately. But it's kind of funny because they say, well, did you know that fence line down there on the 160 is about 5 feet off for about 200 yards? I was like, no, I didn't even know that. But it's like, oh, boy. But, you know, when you start trying to dot the team, we can dot the I's and cross the T's. We'll have to do, you know, a little bit of both of that. May work. I'm encouraged about it, though. I think main thing is my father-in-law, he's real good about that. He was working with him a lot. And it's fun to read his letters. He used to handwrite letters, amazing, to the Forest Service, and I'd read through those. He had beautiful handwriting, too.
Not the lost art right there.
Oh, man, big.
I would love to kind of end this out on a happy, fun note. So I would love to hear a story about something funny that happened in your time at the ranch.
Oh, I think there's a couple of those going on. There was a guy that showed up with the family there one time. He had come from Egypt, of all places. I was head wrangler at the time. And he got there on Sunday night, and you can only imagine the trip they went through, but he was from the United States. I mean, his family, I think he must have been working in the petroleum industry or something over there. But anyway, he showed up and comes out there the next morning, got his cowboy hat on and his boots, and they're all ready, fired up to go ride and everything. And one of the wranglers came over, and they told me, they said, Harley, you see that guy over there, the guy from Egypt? I said, yeah. And so, well, he's got his hat on backwards. And I was like, well, you know, that's not a sin or anything. And they said, well, what do we tell him, you know, because we're afraid his hat will blow off when he gets up there on the side of the hill or something. And well, I told him, I said, well, there's only one thing you can do. And they said, what's that? I said, well, turn your hats around backwards. They looked at me like they were wild. And I said, yeah, just put your hats on backwards. And then when he sees you, he'll get the message. But it was so funny. I'll never forget that because it was like 10 people were walking around with all their hats wrong backwards. And the other people are like, what's going on here? You know, that's what's fun, you know, is when you have something like that happen and makes you laugh. But there's another time too when we were we have a breakfast ride on Wednesday mornings. We ride down up the creek, not more than 3/4 of a mile, and it's still on ranch property, and we have breakfast up there. Get up, the chef will send up bacon and pancakes, and they cook them all up there on a barbecue grill. It's really fun. But anyway, it's kind of a big deal because you got, you know, anywhere from probably 13, 14 wranglers and staff up there. And then you got up to 32 to 36 guests up there, and getting all the horses up there and getting them off, you know, tying all the horses up. Anyway, have breakfast, and we do this deal where the chef will cook extra pancakes, and then they have a pancake tots for the kid. And so they will go when they've had their breakfast and they're ready to, some of them will elect to come home, and then some of them go on another short ride before lunch. So that particular morning, they all wanted to go back. And we had like, I kid you not, there was probably like up to 60 people in one long line, and we were all headed back to the ranch. So we get, and it just so happened that I was leading that ride, and I was riding what we call a green horse again. You know, do as I say, not as I do.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm riding along there, and she was a gentle mare, but still had some spunk to her, you know. And so we get up going into the alleyway, what we call the alleyway, just to the west of the barn. You cross a little creek, and there was, I was halfway, just like, right, only had like maybe 60 yards to go. And so I look over my shoulder, and this little girl, like this little tiny girl on this real nice horse, her horse breaks the line and runs over to, we had a stallion in a corral that was about 50 yards away. And that horse of hers that she was on wanted to go over there and fight with that stallion.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was like, oh, my gosh. And so normally I don't wear spurs, but I had spurs on that morning. And I kicked that mare just as hard as I could, both put the kelish to the belly. And she bucked me off. I guarantee I did a complete somersault in the air. Literally did a complete somersault, and I landed on the ground sitting up, and I still had my hat on. Meanwhile, somebody, one of the wranglers went and took care of the new girl, and everything worked out. But this guest rode up beside me. He goes, "Harley, that was amazing." And I said, "What do you mean amazing?" He goes, "Do you practice getting off like that all the time?" I'm not kidding you. I was just sitting on the ground because I couldn't believe that I didn't land on my head or something. It could have been a bad wreck. And like I say, I still have my hat on. 9 times out of 10, your hat goes flying and everything. But it was so funny because he rode up and he thought that was like just another daily routine. Anyway.
That's a great
story. I was just like, yeah, I try to do this once a day. I didn't know what to say.
You got to give the guests their money worth. You got to backflip, dismount those horses all the time.
That's right.
Well, Harley, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Is there anything you want to leave me with before I let you go?
Well, yeah, there was another time when we used to take some of the repeat guests. Their kids have been coming for several years. So we were running out of things to do with them. So we took them on a pack trip up in the above East Minor, and it was close by, you know, and all that. And so we packed all the food and got them all up there. And so I built a little place under some trees, kind of wove a little roof and everything, and got all set up, had everybody in their sleeping bags. All the horses were tied up. Long about 1 o'clock in the morning, I heard a horse like that. When they sense that there's something that's going to eat them, they'll make a really loud, they'll just blow their nose like, ooh.
Uh-huh. Heard it.
So anyway, I heard that, it was a bright kind of an evening, and I looked out there and I couldn't see anything. So I thought, man, I better go check, you know, and see what's going on. Well, I go walking around and I'm marching around there trying to find a bear or whatever it was, as if I was going to do anything about it. But I kind of wanted to know because I didn't want to lose all our horses or whatever, but I got about halfway around and I looked down and I didn't realize that I was in my underwear only with shoes on. And I thought, Harley, what are you thinking about here? And so that's what I call going bear hunting with a switch. As if I was going to make a difference in my underwear.
I think you'd have made a difference, Harley. I think you'd pulled it off.
Yeah. Man, I don't know. You know how that goes. It, that's another thing too, is that awareness thing. You know, it's like, what was I not thinking there?
Sometimes your bravado takes the lead.
Yeah, isn't that the truth?
Well, again, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and we'll look forward to the next 50 years for Red Rock Ranch. Make 2024 your year to experience the Red Rock Ranch. With 50 years of history wedged between the Gros Ventre Mountains and the towering Tetons, there's never been a better time to visit. Get started now at theredrockranch.com.